Chell Silverstein is a name that resonates with lots of different people for lots of different reasons. You may have grown up reading his children's books. If you're a music junkie, you might tip your hat to him for songs he wrote, including A Boy Named Sue. If you're a journalist, you might remember him for his reporting and cartoons for Playboy magazine. Well, either way, there's lots to be excited about by the posthumously released book of his called Everything on It. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we celebrate the life and work of Chell Silverstein. And our guest is Marv Gold. Marv grew up with Chell Silverstein, and he's written and produced a dozen films and plays since then, and one of them is called Chell Silverstein, A Memoir. And his novels include Marley's Boat and Forbidden Army. And we're looking forward to your take on Chell Silverstein. Do you have a favorite book or song that you'd like to remember? And what do you think it is that makes his work so unique? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Marv Gold, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I think it would be a good thing if we began this hour by listening to one of Chell Silverstein's works. Here's one called Tug of War.
I will not play at tug of war. I'd rather play at hug of war, where everyone hugs instead of tugs, and where everyone giggles and rolls on the rug, and where everyone kisses and everyone grins and everyone cuddles and everyone wins.
Piece there called Tug of War. Are you familiar with that one, Marv?
Yes, I am.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was meant to be a shorter version. And the one that I'm familiar with is the one that you just quoted Chell on. And it started as a poem, and is still reprinted as a poem, but he also converted it into a song. Hmm. And he does present it as almost as a song.
Well, now, that makes sense, given his background,
yes,
kind of going back and forth between all these different disciplines.
Now, there's a line in there about rolling on the rug, which has become questionable by some of his fans and critics. Did it mean a roll in the hay? Or exactly what did it mean? Well, it was, yes, it was sensual, but I don't think I'd call it sexual. But that's my one comment on that work.
Well, you grew up with Chell Silverstein, and you knew him pretty well, and by all accounts, he wasn't necessarily an easy guy to get to know. When did you first make friends with him?
I was 6, and Chell was 5, and that would have been 1935. I got to know him because we were both interested in trading comic books. We collected them, new ones, old ones, beat up ones, torn ones, and every so often we'd get together and do some trading, which was very common in those years. And it grew into sort of a distant friendship. He was not the most embracing guy, nor probably was I at that age.
Hmm.
I'm surprised that we were able to read a comic book. But out of that grew some neighborhood games, and we went on from there. He attended a different grade school than I did, so we didn't get chummy in school. He went to Darwin Elementary in Chicago, on a street called Belden, in a neighborhood called Logan Square, and even more specifically, Palmer Park.
Mm-hmm.
He lived on Palmer Street. And exactly 2853 Palmer Street. And I was a couple of blocks down on the corner of Shakespeare and St. Louis. And I went to Funston Elementary. But we reunited in high school and went on from there. We spent the rest of our lives sort of in contact or working things out. I don't know. We went to, sorts of events.
Did he always have this talent for drawing and as a cartoonist that obviously he had as an adult?
You know, he started it that way, tracing Al Capp's Lil Abner, and was proud of his cartoon work. But he kind of early in high school realized he was more of a humorist that happens to draw. He was not the world's greatest cartoonist or illustrator, but he knew he had a good sense of humor. His outlook was so inverse. It was just illogical. And that kind of helped him become a humorist and a writer. And he remained all of that, as well as excelling in cartoon work from high school on.
I think one of the interesting things about him is that he's probably, I'm going to say, best known for his children's books, things like The Giving Tree, Where the Sidewalk Ends, things like that. But he lived in the Playboy Mansion at one point, and he worked for Playboy for a long time as well as a cartoonist.
40 years.
It's a long time. So he has a sort of edgy side to him, and also this soft, cuddly side, which children's books readers know. Tell us about sort of those two aspects of his life and his personality.
Well, there was an aspect of his life that wouldn't admit that he had sort of a children's outlook. Part of the time, he was sort of childish. And he spent many years trying to overcome that and become manly.
Hmm.
So he had this conflict going and contradictions going, but eventually settled down into the writing part, which always included the children's poems and the lyrics for folk songs. So he finally resolved it and wound up sort of a recluse in Key West many years later, where he died. So did I answer you, I hope?
Well, I'd like to get a little bit more in detail about, you know, he's four decades at Playboy magazine. What did he do for them?
For Playboy, he founded their cartoon department, if there is such a thing. But he happened to get very lucky in meeting Hefner, Hugh Hefner, the publisher. Because for some years after the service, he couldn't afford to get a streetcar ride. He couldn't get a job cartooning. He kind of knocked himself out. He became a vendor at Comiskey Park for the Andy Frayne Usher organization. So here's the part that he got lucky at. Without realizing it, he called on Hefner and found out Hefner himself was a published cartoonist.
Hmm.
So there was an immediate chemistry between them, even though Hef could have been 20 years older. They were just starting out, and they had no staff. And Hefner kind of stalled him along on freelance work until he could afford to pay him a salary. And it turned out to be a wonderful friendship, because it gave Shell a chance to move out of his parents' home and into the mansion where Hefner kept an apartment.
So he moves from his parents' home into the Playboy Mansion?
Yes.
That's quite a juxtaposition.
Well, he did it kind of gradually. He first moved into the Playboy neighborhood to a YMCA and then to a little private basement apartment. But these were just for a month or two.
Right.
And finally, he asked Hefner if he could occupy the residential apartment on the second floor, which adjoined the quarters, the dorm, of the Playgirls, all the bunnies. So that worked out magically for his own growth, but not necessarily his maturity. So he did that for years, and in fact, on all of his visits back to Chicago, he lived at the mansion. I also I'm doing my films, I happened to show them at the mansion on Friday nights. So I became kind of a guest and I suppose a pest too. But somehow or other, once again, Shell and I crossed paths, as we had been doing for, well, since high school, since the service, since art school. We constantly bumped into each other, and it became a little intentional after a while.
Anyhow. Well, you mentioned that he began, and his arm had to be twisted to convince him that he had this aspect that really did fit a children's audience. How did he make the segue then?
Well, you got to handle that with care, because according to Michelle, everything he ever got into, he was talked into or whipped into or bribed. He liked to believe and liked to profess that he was hustled, and he did things under protest. But it wasn't so. It just didn't happen that way. When Shell came into the light verse, the children's verse, it was of his own choice. And he kind of set that up. He kind of maneuvered the situation so that it would appear that he was employed, but actually he was seeking employment. So you have to take many of his statements with about two or three grains of salt. And that's one of them. What really happened with a publisher called, at that time, it was called Harper Row. Now it's called Harper Collins. What happened was he knew they had a children's editorial division, and many decisions came out of that as to what to publish. On the board, there was even a child cartoonist named William Cole. And the two of them crossed swords a few times. At any rate, how could he possibly invade Harper Row and get to meet the one of the editors named Ursula Nordstrom? And he kind of scratched his head a lot in New York. He was on the outs at that period with Hefner in Chicago, and he was looking to graduate into a writing job. And he remembered a pal that he'd met at the mansion, a designer named Tommy Ungerer. Shell plainly called him Tommy Underwear. Tommy was a Dutch designer and cartoonist, very popular, very well-to-do, very reprinted in various magazines. And they sat down in some New York saloon one day, and Shell put his cards on the table that he really wanted to get into this field of Tommy's. And Tommy asked him, "What have you got? What can you do?" And Shell rattled off about three or four poems that are in the memoir. And Tommy was very impressed and said, "Let's get together. I'll set up an appointment, and we'll meet with Ursula." When they did, Ursula practically collapsed with mirth. She just was thrilled to see the artist she enjoyed in Playboy magazine and to see his submissions, because he had various things he wanted to talk about. Some of his goofy animals were in there, and a child's viewpoint came through. And so she asked for more material, and he came through with that, and lo and behold, they had a book going. The Uncle Shelby first book, which was Lefkadio the Lion, I believe. And they went to town on that, including in 64, I think, The Giving Tree, which is probably their best seller.
Right, and I want to talk about The Giving Tree, actually. We have a clip
Don't
of that.
Don't ask me. I'm very split on that subject.
You're split on it. Good
Go
man.
Ahead.
Pardon the pun, right? Okay, so here is The Giving Tree. This is a reading of it.
But the boy stayed away for a long time, and the tree was sad. And then one day the boy came back, and the tree shook with joy, and she said, "Come, boy, come climb up my trunk and swing from my branches and have fun." "I'm too busy to climb trees," said the boy. "I need a house to keep me warm. I want a wife and I want children, so I need a house. Can you give me a house?" "I have no house," said the tree. "The forest is my house. But you may cut off my branches and build a house." And so the boy cut off her branches and carried them away to build his house. And the tree was happy.
And we heard a bit of The Giving Tree there, which was a huge hit for Shel Silverstein.
It's still a bestseller.
It's one that I have read to my son, and he loves it, but I read it, and I'm thoroughly depressed. But a lot of people love that book. Tell us a little bit about it, and then we'll try to get our listeners in on this.
Well, you have to immediately understand that the book is directed at mothers, at women, and it kind of shows their nature, the sheltering and the serving and care for her son. So it has a kind of a limited appeal to men, at any rate, and perhaps other people that can sort of see through it. It's very self-centered. This is Shel, his viewpoint and his belief in taking, while the mother's role is one of giving. That's where I got off the subject. What I seriously recognize these days is that it was Shel's one and only salute to his own mother, a lady named Helen Balcany, or Balcony, married to Nathan Silverstein. He adored his mother. She was the only one in the whole family that understood him. And this was his way of thanking her and acknowledging their roles. So I guess I tempered some of my disbelief,
your criticism,
the understanding of Shel and his mother.
Well, hearing it as an ode to a mother is a different read on it. I like knowing that. So thank you for that. And we'll take a break right now and then come back and get some of our listeners in on this as we talk with Marv Gold, who grew up with Shel Silverstein. He's written a memoir about him. It's called Shel Silverstein. And we'd love to know what you think. Complex guys we're hearing this hour. What do you think about his work? What are your favorite poems, songs, and stories? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
But he didn't want my head. He only wanted to know the way to Denver. I met a devil. But he didn't want my soul. He only wanted to borrow my bike a while. I met a vampire, but he didn't want my blood. He only wanted two nickels for a dime. I keep meeting all the right people, but all the wrong.
Little clip there from Monsters I've Met by Shel Silverstein. And there is a new book of Shel Silverstein's that was released this fall, and it's called Everything On It. And we're taking that as an excuse to look at and celebrate the life and works of Shel Silverstein, taking a look at his poems and how he got to the place he was. Now, Marv, one thing people don't know probably is that Shel Silverstein also wrote songs, and a couple big ones, in fact, including A Boy Named Sue, which Johnny Cash did to great effect, and also the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Yep, that's all true. Veronica, he wrote 800 songs, most of them pretty good, and some of them highly specialized. He wrote an album for truck drivers, another for cowboys, and thirdly, kind of a porno album. So he was very prolific as far as songwriting. It was the major source of his income.
And he was pretty good at it, I have to say.
Yes, yes, he was.
Well, he did have that gift with words. Well, let's go to our first caller. We've got Tom joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning, Veronica. Great show. I'm really enjoying the background on Shel Silverstein because I used to be a third grade teacher a number of years ago, and I had several of his books that I keep right behind my desk. And I would like to share one poem that was one of my favorites. I'd usually like to read it to the kids when they would come back in from recess, lunch, you know, and they kind of needed a little calming down period. So I'd just grab a book and start reading some poems. And one of the ones that I would read to them was Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout.
Ah, yes.
That also became a song. Go right ahead, Tom.
Oh, okay, but that was one of my favorites, but it's really hard to pick one favorite when it comes to Shel Silverstein because I have so many, but another good one was Jimmy Jett and his TV set, and the kids just got a kick out of that one, too. So I just thank you for the program. It's great.
Great. Well, you're welcome, and in fact, we've got a treat for you. We have a little clip from the poem you just mentioned, Sarah Cynthia Stout, and how she did not want to take the garbage out. So here it is.
Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout would not take the garbage out. She'd scour the pots and scrape the pans, candy the yams and spice the hams, and though her daddy would scream and shout, she simply would not take the garbage out. And so it piled up to the ceilings, coffee grounds, potato peelings, brown bananas, rotten peas, chunks of sour cottage cheese. It filled the can, it covered the floor, it cracked the window, it blocked the door with bacon rinds and chicken bones, drippy ends of ice cream cones.
And there we have a clip from the one that Tom was mentioning. Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout would not take the garbage out. And that's a fun one. Do you have a favorite, Marv?
Do I? I probably do, but I swear I can't quote it to you right now. There are some that I love to reread. I want to go backwards to Sarah Sylvia Cynthia Stout. And when you hear Shel do that poem, you get an entirely different drift to his style because the tempo increases and it gets to be, in its last lines, just a sort of machine gun list of garbage that she refused to take out.
Hmm.
It gets very funny towards the end as he goes through this long, quick list. Now, I'm trying to recall one of his earlier poems that I like, and I'll think about it, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, can you tell us something about this new release? Now, this is a posthumously released book called Everything On It, and I gather that some people say that these were just throwaway materials that really never made the cut to be good enough to make it into the books, and some say this is just as good as the other material.
Well, that's sort of my impression, too. I recently lectured a group of grad students here in San Diego at SDSU, San Diego State University. And the whole class, there may have been 25 students there, had some very strong negative feelings about the posthumous release, because it's fairly well known that Shel kept a dresser drawer full of scraps of notes of germs of ideas that he would work on later. Well, this became the material that HarperCollins collected and screened and sifted through and created Everything On It. So it's really doesn't seem to be up to speed. So far, I have not read it because I'm still immersed in his earlier work. But I'll get there, you know, probably this year. Someone will get me one as a Christmas gift or something. I don't think Shell really did a bad verse or a bad song or short play or movie or anything of that nature. So I expect it to be a mixed bag. I'm still looking for the...
But I imagine even maybe Shel Silverstein work that's not up to snuff is still pretty good.
Sometimes it's still pretty good.
Sometimes
right.
It can be a window into a great mind and a great artist, too.
Right.
Well, let's take another call. Tom joins us from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Doing pretty good. How about you?
Fantastic. Listen, I'm it's a great subject. I grew up in Chicago and became acquainted with Shel Silverstein's work through Bob Gibson to begin with. And mostly to begin with in high school and through Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show. And all the crazy, I got stoned and I missed it sort of songs. And then when he ended up as a children's author, at first I thought it was a different guy.
Yeah.
And it seemed like about that time too, Cheech Marin went from being half of Cheech and Chong to a Walt Disney children's movie actor. Is there something between a crazy, you know, drug libertine lifestyle and being a fantastic children's writer?
Is there some connection there?
Yeah. Is it a childlike thing that happens, or is it a byproduct?
I don't think it has helped him write any better. As a matter of fact, I think it's had a deterrent effect on Shell, because he was sort of a children's writer even at Playboy long before he got into drugs. If you remember Uncle Shelby, and which was about 1961, long before his published works, his cartoon style at that time was childlike, and his viewpoint of representing kids' thoughts was, in effect, in that whole stream of features he did for Playboy. So I don't see any connection between, you know, some of his screwing around and his poetry.
Interesting question, though, Tom. Thank you for that call. And another thing that we may not know about Shel Silverstein is that he did serve in the Army for quite a while. Tell us about that.
He was voted the world's worst soldier of all time. Yes, he did serve it about a year after I was discharged. Let's say 52 and 53 for Shel. And I was discharged, I think, in 52. Yes. Rings a bell. I was a personnel management guy stationed at Fort Sheridan. My main job was interviewing and assigning personnel to special camps or basic training. At that time, I never saw Shell, because I was coming out in 52 as he was going in. But part of my job had to do with assigning recruits to places like Schofield Barracks in Hawaii and to Pacific Headquarters in Tokyo and on further to Korea, or it was during the Korean War, which ended in 52. So I guess I remember that period. And he was just a crummy soldier. Well, all he wanted to do was hang out in Tokyo. he did cartoons for the Pacific edition of Stars and Stripes. And I believe it may have been a daily, but let's say it was a weekly. I believe Shell did a cartoon per week. He frequently was criticized for making fun of commissioned officers. That's a real no-no.
So he had that subversive side to him even then.
Exactly. That's the truth of that. And a couple of times he was almost court-martialed and kicked out. But he managed to find some sympathetic superiors who kind of controlled him and held him down, and he avoided any disgrace.
So what came out of that Army period? Did you see that kind of having any echoes in the work that he did later?
Yes. In fact, it provided, that work provided entree to Playboy. It's interesting how things led, his whole life led from one stage into another. He wrote, he drew, and did some writing too, critical cartoons of Army life, and assembled them into a book, his first and only military book, and it was called something like and eventually the title became Drop Your Socks, something like that. And that was the booklet that I discussed with him during his searching around Chicago for a publisher. I said, you already have samples, Shell. It's all your Army stuff. Show it around town. There's a new magazine called Playboy. And he did eventually gain access to Hugh Hefner, himself a published cartoonist, who drew the book, That Toddle in Town. And Hefner was thrilled. He saw his own style and his own work in Shell's stuff and hired him.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
We
heard about some of the shenanigans at the Playboy Mansion. I'm sure there are many that we can't discuss on the air as well. But let's get back to what Shell is best known for, those wonderful, those poems and those stories and the songs. We can listen to a little bit of music as well. And we'd love to know what resonates with you in terms of Shel Silverstein. What sticks with you that you maybe read growing up, and what are you still reading to your children? Do you think Shel Silverstein still holds up as a great children's author? I think many people do. His number is 1-800, or rather our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send us an email as well. You can reach us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in for Kathleen Dunn. And you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 2 o'clock today, you can listen to Talk of the Nation. Today, film buff Murray Horowitz talks about the beloved film A Christmas Story, plus the cycles we live by and how they affect everything from where we live to how we eat. That's 2 o'clock's Talk of the Nation. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. And this hour, we're celebrating the life and work of Shel Silverstein. There was a new book published from his archives, posthumously released, published this fall, called Everything on It. And we're taking a look back now at the career of Shel Silverstein. And here's something you may not know that he did. He wrote the book, the song A Boy Named Sue, that Johnny Cash made famous. And we'll take a listen now.
Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I just hit town, and my throat was dry. Thought I'd stop and have myself a brew. At an old saloon on a street of mud, man at a table, dealing studs, a dirty, mangy hound, who named me Sue. Well, I knew that snake was my own sweet dad from a worn-out picture that my mother had had. I knew that scar on his cheek and his evil eye.
He was kind of bent. Grand old, I looked at him. My blood run cold, I said,
my name is Sue. How do you do? Now you're gonna die.
Now, you might not have heard that version of A Boy Named Sue because it was featuring Johnny Cash and Shel Silverstein.
And
his
Shel
was the high voice, very energetic there in the background. It's kind of cool to hear his voice because you think of him as sort of a silent guy when you read his writings, but he sounds like he had a lot of energy.
Yes, you're right. He had a very abrasive style of speech and singing. I'm trying to recall a poem that I liked a lot. And his first collection, I think it was called Where the Sidewalk Ends. And it may well be in there. The poem is called Sister for Sale. And that was Shel's own attitude towards his own sister.
I remember that one, yeah.
Now, he wrote it tongue-in-cheek. But in high school, in, let's say, 1947, he popped up with that idea that I should buy his sister. Well, I knew Peggy from high school. She was also attending Roosevelt High. And I said, you've got to be kidding. Who would want to buy her? He said, well, I'll make you a deal. I'll make you an offer. And he was practically willing to give her away.
Well, I'm feeling sorry for the sister there. But at least a great poem came out of it there. That's a fun one. And
yes.
Let's go to a phone call now. We've got Paul joining us from Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hello.
I loved Shel Silverstein as a child. I particularly loved the poem books, Where the Sidewalk Ends. I didn't like The Giving Tree, because I felt like it's got bad boundaries. And I remember pretty early on thinking, like, you're not supposed to completely give everything away.
Right, yeah.
But I remember a very large coffee table book that we had, and I believe it was called Different Dances, that was a very adult Shel Silverstein. And I remember looking at it, I was old enough to understand that this was beyond me and not childhood stuff. And I ended up finding a used copy on Amazon a few years ago. It was quite expensive. I think I bought it for $100 used because it's not in print. And it's a fascinating book of very adult poems and drawings.
Okay. Well, I haven't heard about that one. Have you, Marv?
Yes, I've read it, but I've never spent the $100 on acquiring it. That's a fascinating collection of his work from Playboy. It was never designed for a children's audience or for parents or teachers, librarians. It was intended for the male readership of Playboy. And it's a very good collection. Some of his very best artwork. I like it a lot. It's probably one of my favorites, although I also like his Around the World travels, which he also excerpted from Playboy. So for all of his complaints to Hefner that he didn't own his own material, he managed to exploit it nonetheless.
There was a fun cartoon in one of his visits to Switzerland I read about where it was a cartoon of him down in some public space saying, I'm going to wait 15 more minutes, and if nobody yodels, I'm going back to my hotel room.
I think that's true, and I don't have it in front of me, but I do recall that.
Well, let's take another call now. We've got Beverly with us from DePere, I think. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. I'm delighted that you're talking about Shel Silverstein. He's one of my favorite authors for children. I do Reader's Theater with children in school, and we do a lot of programs that incorporate Shel Silverstein's lovely, wonderful poetry. And one of my favorites is Sick. So if we're doing a program on school, it goes, I cannot go to school today, said little Piggy Ann McKay. I have the measles and the mumps, a gash, a rash, and purple bumps. And it goes on and on.
Wow.
Explain why you can't go, why she can't go or he can't go to school. So the lines divide up. And then at the very end, it says, what's that? What's that you say? You say today is Saturday?
Saturday.
Goodbye. I'm going out to play.
Oh.
And it's a wonderful one to use at the end of a program.
Right. Beverly, I remember that one. You brought back such memories. That's
a very good reading of it.
You do. Yeah. You should record some of these. That was fantastic. And he really did, you know. He did capture a lot of how you felt as a kid. I mean, maybe he had this very edgy side, but he certainly also had a child's mind that he kind of carried with him in another sense. We have a similar poem here that we can take a listen to. This is Homework Machine.
Just put in your homework and drop in a dime, snap on the switch, and in 10 seconds' time, your homework comes out quick and clean as can be. Here it is, 9 plus 4, and the answer is 3. 3. Oh, me. I guess it's not as perfect as I thought it would be.
A clip from The Homework Machine there.
Yep.
And that's another fun one. Let's take another call now. We've got Billy joining us from Phillips. Hi, Billy.
Hi. I am so pleased that we're talking about Silverstein again. I remember vaguely that when my children were young, I was able to get tapes of Shell reading his own work. Is that something that I only fantasized?
Marv?
I don't think there are any more tapes like that being produced. Most of his stuff is now on CD and maybe sometimes on film. But I think the tapes sort of date you a little.
Well, I'm sure, judging by the energy we heard, that he would be a fantastic reader. And let's take a Facebook comment now. And by the way, we've got a couple of open phone lines for you to call up and share your favorite Shel Silverstein work. You can quote a little bit or you can just tell us about it. And this is from Shannon, who writes, I always loved Shel Silverstein, but when I was 6, I saw the photo of him on the back of the dust jacket of the book, and he absolutely terrified me. To my 6-year-old self, he looked really scary and not at all like the man who I envisioned having written my favorite books. I think I had a reaction like that, too. I think there was a giant photograph of him on the back of the book.
Yes.
And he didn't look like what you expected. He looked a little more severe.
One of those portraits of Shell shows him with a chipped front tooth. And yet another one, another back cover, shows him with a corrected tooth. So take your choice, the power of Photoshop or something. I know what you mean, and it is difficult for me to visualize the grown-up Shell. My memory is of a bushy-haired kid, probably never had a haircut, with a pug nose, just a little pug nose, and a great kind of gangly little figure. So it's still difficult for me to picture him. As we see him these days. I don't know how he ever got the hawk nose. I don't want to know. I don't know why in the world he shaved his head, except to, again, appear more manly, the same reason that he grew a beard. Somehow that was a trademark. He wanted very hard to be an icon, and that was as close as he came to it.
Well, we have another Facebook comment from Julie, who says, I just bought the new book last night for my 9-year-old daughter, and I'm not sure which one of us was more excited to start reading it. And she wants to know whether Shell had any children. And thank you, by the way, Julie, for that Facebook comment. And if you'd like to send us an email, too, you can do so at talk@wpr.org, or you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And so what about it, Marv? Did Shell have children?
Yes, he had 2 kids. His daughter called Shanna, but her name was Shoshana, died at the age of perhaps 9 or 10. Of an aneurysm, and that kind of destroyed Shell's courage, I guess. His, he became a very different guy. He became a true hermit with her death. Next, while in Key West, a girlfriend of his gave birth to a boy named Matthew. Matthew is probably about 25, 27 by now. And Matthew grew up in Madison,
Wow.
Because that's where his mother moved. And out of discretion for her, I'm not about to name her. But these days, Matthew lives, I believe, in Brooklyn, where he's studying music.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, that's you would expect an author like this to have children, but maybe he didn't need children to get inside the children's mind.
No, he didn't. He already occupied that space. I don't think he was very fond of children as a group or as an audience. But he liked playing with like Bob Gibson's kids or Joe Mapes' kids. You know, a few kids here and there kind of tickled him. Yeah, I guess that was part of his research.
Well, let's take another call here. Lorraine joins us from Lindenhurst, Illinois. Hello.
Good morning. My memories, I grew up in my teens and young adulthood in the Logan Square area, just as you described. And as I got older, I became aware of Shel Silverstein on the Midnight Special that was on Saturday nights on WFMT. And I thought of his humor as being offbeat, which was great. I mean, he seemed to be a favorite of the program. And so I thought it was quite a contrast when I heard that he was doing children's books, which were just an absolute delight.
So on that Midnight Special, what kind of things did they air?
Midnight Special was...
a potpourri.
Pardon?
It was a potpourri.
Folk music, show tunes, and comedy. Mm. And they were on the air for many, many years. And I think they started in the late 50s, early 60s when WFMT started. So he, when you mentioned Bob Gibson, Old Town School of Folk Music, things like that, he was instrumental in the beginning of that.
Well, interesting. Sounds like an interesting venue for Shel Silverstein.
Who can forget Studs Terkel?
Mm.
You remember Studs?
Oh, yeah. And so was he on there as well?
Yes, he was, because the program, which was called the Midnight Special, I think appeared on Saturday nights. And they collected the best programs of the week, including Studs Terkel's interviews. And he was extremely popular and remained with that station for many, many years.
Well, we are nearing the end of the hour here. Why don't we take the opportunity to listen to one more poem? This is a bit of Where the Sidewalk Ends, one of his best known.
There is a place where the sidewalk ends, and before the street begins, and there the grass grows soft and white, and there the sun burns crimson bright, and there the moonbird rests from his flight to cool in the peppermint wind. Let us leave this place where the smoke blows black, and the dark street winds and bends, past the pits where the asphalt flowers grow. We shall walk with a walk that is measured and slow, and watch where the chalk-white arrows go, to the place where the sidewalk ends. Yes, we'll walk with a walk that is measured and slow, and we'll go where the chalk-white arrows go. For the children, they mark, and the children, they know, the place where the sidewalk ends.
A reading there from Where the Sidewalk Ends, one of Shel Silverstein's poems, one of his the title of one of his books as well, and one of the most popular. And Marv, it's really been a pleasure talking about Shel Silverstein, a fascinating guy, and it's wonderful to hear about his life and work and keep him alive. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, too. You brought back many pleasant memories.
And time to go read some more. The holidays are a good time to read poems like this. And check out that new book, Everything On It, as well, which was released in the fall and from the archives of Shel Silverstein. Well, Marv Gold grew up with Shel Silverstein. He's written and produced a dozen films and plays since then, and he's the author of Shel Silverstein and Me, a memoir. And thank you to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour's program, and Chrissy Pease for production help as well. Kathleen Dunn will be back with you in another week. Next week, John Munson will be in. And if you'd like a copy of any of the programs today, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444, and ask for program 1222D or E. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network.